Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The waters are believed to sit atop vast reserves of oil and gas. In another attempt to counter China, the U.S. has opened an embassy in the Solomon Islands after a 30-year absence as it seeks to boost diplomatic relations in the Pacific. The last U.S. embassy in the Solomon Islands closed in 1993. The move comes after China struck a security pact with Solomon Islands last year. It was the first known bilateral security agreement between China and a country in the Pacific. The region has become the center of a geopolitical and strategic tug-of-war between China and the U.S. Meanwhile, NATO, which is a U.S.-led military bloc, is trying to bolster its ties with Japan in a bid to strengthen an alliance against China. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has visited Japan, saying the Western military alliance will continue to strengthen its partnership with Tokyo.
Beijing is watching closely and learning lessons that may influence its future decisions. What is happening in Europe today could happen in East Asia tomorrow. So we must remain united and firm, standing together for freedom and democracy.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and in recent years, it has expanded its military ties with other Indo-Pacific nations, as well as the United Kingdom, Europe, and NATO. Back in December, Tokyo unveiled a new national security strategy that will see a large increase in its military capabilities. The strategy includes the deployment of long-range missiles. Japan also hopes to ease restrictions on arms export to strengthen its military industry.
The harsh treatment of the Israeli regime against Palestinian prisoners is continuing unabated. At least 120 Palestinian inmates in an Israeli jail are on hunger strike in protest against the regime's repressive measures. The Palestinian Prisoners Society has said the Palestinian political prisoners started the mass strike to protest against the inhumane conditions at Israel's notorious Negev prison.
Ben-Gavir announced plans to implement several punitive measures against incarcerated Palestinians, and he's continuing with more aggressive decisions. These measures are meant to drag the Palestinian prisoners into confrontations with the soldiers.
The commission said the inmates announced their decision to launch a hunger strike in response to the new repressive measures imposed on them by Israeli prison authorities. The development came after Israeli forces stormed several sections in Megiddo, Ofer, and Negev Desert prisons, attacking Palestinian prisoners and placing a group of them in solitary confinement. The Palestinian resistance factions have warned that detention in prisons will not stay within their walls. They say harming the prisoners will have repercussions within and outside Israeli prisons.
The vicious attack on the prisoners will lead to serious consequences. The prisoners are not alone. They always find support and serious stand from the whole Palestinians. It seems this current regime wants a war on all fronts because the situation in the occupied territories is already boiling.
Reports say the move is in response to the abuses suffered by inmates in Section 26 and 27 in the Negev, the transfer of others from Section 8 to Section 6 in the same prison, and depriving them of their possessions and basic needs. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held under administrative detention, in which Israel keeps the detainees without charge for up to 6 months, a period which can be extended an infinite number of times. The detention takes place on orders from a military commander and on the basis of what the Israeli regime describes as secret evidence. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years. Rights groups describe Israel's use of administrative detention as a bankrupt tactic and have long called on Israel to end this move.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. and nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
There are reportedly more than 7,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at the illegal detentions. Israeli jail authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under deplorable conditions without proper hygienic standards. Palestinian inmates have also been subject to systematic torture, harassment, and repression.
The U.S. announced on January 25th that it will send 31 M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. The tanks may take months or even years to arrive and may never see the battlefield. The M1 Abrams is the main battle tank of the U.S. military and is one of the most powerful and sophisticated tanks in the world. But for Ukraine, that is both the advantage and the problem. In his comments announcing the decision, U.S. President Joe Biden said that delivering the tanks to Ukraine will take time without further specification.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
Military analysts say it could take a year or more for all these Abrams to make it to Ukraine. So any expectations that these tanks will have an immediate impact on the fighting needs to be tempered. The tanks will be purchased from General Dynamics, the manufacturer of the tank. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said it will take many months for General Dynamics to build them. Kirby said the U.S. doesn't have the extra tanks in its arsenal, and even if there were excess tanks, it would still take many months, suggesting that the unbuilt tanks will take even longer to arrive. While the estimated timeline suggests that the tanks cannot have an immediate impact on the conflict, it seems that may never have been the intention. The decision may have been more strategic and diplomatic than military. The Biden administration made the decision against the advice of the Pentagon. The tank the U.S. really wants on the battlefields of Ukraine is the German Leopard 2. But Germany was never going to send them without the cover of the U.S. agreeing to send their tanks. In case there was any doubt, on January 19th, at the World Economic Forum, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz privately but very directly told the U.S. delegation that Germany was not going to send their tanks until the U.S. agreed to send theirs. The U.S. may never have intended the Abrams tanks for the current war. They may not even be the right tanks for this war. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley had both recommended against sending M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. In addition to how long it takes to train personnel to operate the tanks and how difficult the tanks are to maintain, they have also said that the Abrams tanks are not the right vehicles for the fight in Ukraine right now. By promising to send the tanks without ever specifying a delivery date, the U.S. may have succeeded in giving Germany and Europe cover to send their Leopard tanks without ever actually sending U.S. tanks onto the current battlefield. Most NATO members in Europe have kept open the possibility of sending their F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, even as U.S. President Joe Biden said Washington would not do so. Air defense experts say U.S.-built F-16 fighter jets would offer Ukraine an edge over the Russian Air Force, but only if combined with powerful missiles and targeting information which the West would also have to provide, drawing it more actively into the war. There are clear advantages to the F-16. It is the world's most produced fighter jet, with many being decommissioned in Europe as NATO members transition to the F-35. Lockheed Martin, which produces the F-16, told the Financial Times it can increase production to replace planes sent to Ukraine. But there are practical and symbolic concerns. Experts say training Ukrainian pilots on F-16s might not be carried out in time to make a difference in the war this year. Also, bringing in Western pilots, even as privateers, could create political complications. Ukraine has reportedly prepared a batch of 50 pilots who have flown in Western military exercises and could be trained in 3 months. The symbolic concern is over losses of aircraft. Russia's development of hypersonic missiles could prove a match for the F-16, ending the narrative of NATO superiority. Perhaps for such reasons, there are still naysayers in the Western alliance. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, after bowing to pressure to send Leopard 2 battle tanks to Ukraine, said he would not be sending the jets. The West, the US in particular, has supplied Ukraine with arms and munitions worth billions of dollars since the beginning of the war in February last year. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has recently doubled down on the need for new weapons from his Western backers to counter Russia's military advances, urging the West to send long-range missiles and fighter jets in addition to tanks.
We have to open the supply of long-range missiles to Ukraine, and it is important that we expand our cooperation in artillery, and we have to start supplying aircraft to Ukraine. This is our dream and our task.
Russia has frequently warned that Western weapons supply to Ukraine will only prolong the war.
While the British public is grappling with an unprecedented cost of living crisis, the dismissal of a high-ranking Tory official has added insult to the injury of millions of Britons. That after it emerged that chairman of the Conservative Party, Nadeem Zahawi, paid a penalty to HM Revenue and Customs over previously unpaid tax as part of a multi-million pound dispute while he was Chancellor. HM Revenue and Customs is a non-ministerial department of the UK government responsible for collecting taxes. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak was quick to react to save his party from yet another scandal. He fired Zahawi for what he called serious breaches of the ministerial code over his tax affairs. An investigation by Sunak's ethics advisor concluded that Zahawi had broken the rules by repeatedly failing to declare an HMRC probe into his tax affairs. The dispute concluded with a £5 million settlement, including a penalty. But on Sunday, Sunak sent a letter to Zahawi saying his ethic advisor had concluded there was, quote, a serious breach of the ministerial code. In the letter, Sunak also announced his removal from the post. The dismissal came as Sunak was under fire himself for initially standing by Zahawi before ordering an internal investigation. But the Premier defended his stance, arguing that integrity in politics was the reason he did not sack the Tory chairman in time.
I think that's the right thing to do, to ensure that we have integrity in politics, but to do that in a professional way, that's what we're doing.
But many Britons remain unsatisfied with Sunak's handling of the issue. They reason out that the Prime Minister, who acted within hours over his advisor's report, should have sacked Zahawi earlier.
Well, Nadeem Zahawi obviously should be thinking about his future, but I think the bigger question here is why the Prime Minister didn't act earlier, what he knew about this situation, and why he seems to be continuously putting the interests of his party above those of his country. He knew there were allegations about Zahawi for a long time. He then knew that Zahawi had been negotiating a deal with HMRC at the same time as he was in charge of HMRC as the Chancellor. So I think the biggest question today isn't actually for Zahawi, it's actually for the Prime Minister.
Sunak also faces scrutiny over whether he knew about the minister's tax affairs and when he was told there could be a reputational risk to the government after Zahawi's appointment in October. Now many, including former high-ranking officials, suggest that Sunak's premiership risks being brought down by scandals swirling around the Tories. One such is a high-stakes parliamentary inquiry into whether Sunak's predecessor Boris Johnson misled lawmakers over Partygate. We'll be right back.
The sacking of Nadeem Zahawi comes as Sunak's government, facing decades-high inflation and a wave of public sector strike, while trailing badly in opinion polls ahead of an expected 2024 election. To many, the tax evasion of Zahawi has not come as a surprise. But for a prime minister who promised accountability, professionalism and integrity while taking office, this is just a disgrace. But what happens when governments, especially in so-called first world countries, are submerged in corruption? Many argue that politics in those countries are too chaotic to the point where things get out of hand, like what happened in the case of Zahawi. So the ironic situation is when a man briefly in charge of the treasury does not pay taxes himself while insisting that others must pay. Apart from that, the UK is already grappling with a cost of living crisis which has been unprecedented in a century. This, coupled with the skyrocketing inflation, have so far prompted hundreds of thousands of workers from various sectors, including railway, postal, dock, energy and medical, to stage walkouts over pay and working conditions. While workers' union accuse the government of inaction and call for talks to resolve the disputes, workers want their pay in line with the inflation that is currently at the level of nearly 11%. The UK is also facing rampant food and energy costs. Some even struggle to make ends meet or even afford to put food on the table.
There's people around here who can't afford to put clothes on their kids' backs or food on their table, and that he has mistakenly missed an error.
Charities are stocking up duvets, sleeping bags, hot water bottles and blankets because they know that people can't afford to heat their homes anymore. That puts in the spotlight the number of governments which one after another took the helm at number 10 and attempted to resolve the cost of living crisis, but to no avail. The much bigger question is that how can the Sunak government run the country when it is unable to cope with this and other crises happening over there?
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
According to economic analysts, the rise in prices and interest rates in the United Kingdom has now become a common concern for many Britons. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story. According to a survey, two-thirds of British consumers are planning to cut their discretionary spending in 2023 amid concerns about the cost of living crisis. Highlighting the pressure on families and the wider economy from inflation, the accountancy firm KPMG said 61% of consumers in a poll of 3,000 were preparing to reduce their spending on eating out, holidays and other non-essentials. The survey found concerns over the cost of basic items such as food, energy, fuel and mortgage or rent costs, as well as worries over how much further these could rise, were the biggest deterrents for discretionary spending. With inflation above 10% for the first time since the early 1980s, households across Britain have tightened their belts to accommodate soaring gas and electricity bills and a rising cost of weekly shopping, prompting the Bank of England to warn about a lengthy recession. Official forecasts show sky-high inflation will erode average real pay and cut living standards by 7% over the 2 years to the end of March 2024, wiping out the previous 8 years of growth. Highlighting the uneven impact for some families, the KPMG survey showed 1 in 10 adults have no savings. Only 4% said they would be able to increase their non-essential spending levels in 2023, while a quarter would stay at their 2022 level. Of these with savings, 43% said they'll be using them to help meet essential costs. This rises to more than 80% among some low-income households, reflecting the disproportionate impact of living costs on poorer families. 1 in 10 consumers highlighted concern about energy bills after April, when the government will reduce the amount of support available to families by increasing the cap on average bill from £2,500 to £3,000 for a typical household. Consumers also cited the end of fixed-term mortgage deals as well as variable-rate mortgages as barriers to their spending. KPMG said a third of consumers in Britain plan to buy more own brand and value products in 2023, while a third would buy fewer items altogether. The most common areas for saving on discretionary spending were eating out, 46%, clothing, 42%, takeaways, 42%. Linda Ellett, UK head of consumer markets, retail and leisure at KPMG, said current essential costs, fears of how high they'll rise, including concerns about mortgage rates and energy price changes next year, are all factors in why two-thirds of consumers that we surveyed said they have to reduce their non-essential spending in 2023. British newspaper The Express has also covered the same story. Amid the worsening cost of living crisis this winter, new research revealed a large proportion of households in Britain are worried about losing their income at some point over the next year. Crippling housing costs have long been one of the main engines of homelessness in Britain, but soaring energy bills and record rents mean more people than ever now find themselves at risk. In order to stave off this most severe of outcomes, many have been cutting back on spending over the holidays. According to a new survey by Beam, a social impact startup helping refugees and homeless people find work and housing, 35% of people in Britain believe they're at risk of becoming homeless in 2023. Conducted in November, these fears reflect escalating concern over rising prices generally. Britain's inflation came in at 10.7% last month, only a slight fall back from the 42-year record high of 11.1% in October. Energy prices have been the main driver of inflation throughout the year, pushing up the cost of heating and using electricity for households to untenable levels, just as the winter cold sets in. Research by the International Monetary Fund published in September found the poorest 10% of households in Britain would be spending 17.8% of their income on energy alone in 2022. Reflecting this, just under half of the BEAM survey's respondents said their housing costs have increased by as much as 22% in the past 6 months, while 32% reported worrying that costs will continue to go up over the next 6 months. The same proportion, about 32%, reported they were concerned they wouldn't be able to cover their housing costs in the near future. If costs were to rise beyond what they could afford and they'd lost their home, a quarter of Britons polled confessed they would have nowhere else to go and would be forced to live on the streets. According to the charity Crisis, homelessness can result from a loss of job, the breakdown of a relationship, or the onset of physical or mental health problems. However, the claim the most common cause is no longer being able to afford housing costs. In the year to March, a total of 133,460 families were affected by homelessness in England, the latest report from the Department of Levelling Up, Housing and Communities, an 11.3% increase on the previous year. British News Weather, the Daily Mail, has also covered the same story. The cost of living crisis is affecting people's retirement plans, with millions of workers across the country deciding to cut back on their pension contributions to help pay for rising food and energy costs. New research from the Pensions Management Institute, PMI, found that in the past year, people have abandoned payments into their retirement funds to keep hold of £550 or more as high interest rates continue to bite. The research body found abandoning such savings could delay employees' plans to pack in work by 3 years, with 28% of those surveyed believing they will never be able to retire. It comes as millions of Britons face a surprise hike in energy bills from 1st of January, as the economic crisis continues to deepen. According to the Pensions Management Institute, PMI, 20% of staff have opted out of their workplace's pension scheme or asked for their contributions reduced over the last year. A further 20% are considering taking similar steps to create some extra cash to use now. By axing their pension contributions each month, those on low salaries of £20,000 a year can boost their take-home pay by around £550 a year. Those higher earners, therefore, will be able to increase their take-home each month even further. However, avoiding pension payments means that employees would miss out on their employer's tax relief, resulting in less being saved for their later years. The Pensions Management Institute, PMI, surveyed 2,000 employees in November and found that 7% had taken a decision to opt out in the last 12 months. A further 13% asked to reduce their pension contributions, meaning they would miss out on parallel contributions from their employer, with a further 20% considering ceasing funding their pension pots. The number of savers feeling impact of the ongoing cost of living crisis was 40%, with three quarters of employees having considerable concerns that the current economic crisis would have a detrimental effect on their retirement plans.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, self-conditioning in self-building. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of self-conditioning, one of the ways of self-building in the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about self-conditioning, it means that we need to condition ourselves in order to stop ourselves from following the wrong path or from following some unnecessary or unwanted actions. On the other hand, we condition ourselves to perform the good actions or the things that are needed in our life. Therefore, it is necessary that when we want to have or we want to perform the self-building, one of the ways is to condition ourselves. For example, we condition ourselves in the beginning of the day that I will not perform anything that is against the Islamic teachings. I will avoid the sins, I will avoid the wrong deeds. The way we do in the month of Ramadan, for example, in the month of Ramadan, when we fast, we know that there are a couple of things that are conditioned that during the fasting you should not perform those things. For example, when we are fasting, we are obliged to not to drink anything, not to eat anything, not to perform a sin. We are obliged to fast or be hungry from the time when it starts till the time when we open the fast. So these are the simple examples that we can use, and these are the ways in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted us to be trained. So month of Ramadan and other months in which we have specific things, these are kind of workshops that trains us to how to self-condition ourselves in order to have the self-building, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of self-conditioning in the self-building. We said that it is necessary that we condition ourselves to perform something, and we gave the example of the month of Ramadan. Similarly, on the Hajj, when we go there, that is also a workshop where we are conditioned to not to perform the things that we put on the ihram or the clothes of the Hajj. Therefore, in our daily life, we can learn from these examples, from these months, from these rituals that we practice in the month of in the different months of Islam, or maybe at the time when we are praying in the 5-time daily prayers, what we do is when we say Allahu Akbar, which is Takbiratul Ihram, after that till the salam that we give at the end, we do not look here and there. We just pray. We focus on the prayers and we try not to eat, drink, talk to others or perform anything. Therefore, these are small examples that can help us in order to condition ourselves for the rest of the day that I will not perform anything. And therefore, if I want to have the self-reformation or self-building, therefore, if I'm conditioning myself, for example, from the Fajr prayer till Zuhr prayer, I will try not to perform any sin. And after that, I can condition myself between the Zuhr and Asr, and then from Asr till Isha or the Maghrib. So this way, I can condition myself in order to not to perform any sins, in order to not to do anything which is unwanted, unnecessary, or maybe it is something which is bad in the society. For example, teasing people, or for example, you know, performing some kind of injustice. Therefore, if I can do this, then I can go ahead towards the self-reformation in a better way, an easy way, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
in the limelight.
Defense Secretary Ben Wallace has told the Sky News that the British Army has fallen behind its peer group and needs investment. It comes after Sky News revealed the US general privately told Wallace that the UK's armed forces are no longer regarded as a top-level fighting force. Defense sources revealed the U.S. general said this decline in war fighting capability needed to be reversed faster than planned in the wake of Russia's special operation in Ukraine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, a senior U.S. military official confidentially told British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace that the UK's armed forces are no longer on par with those of the leading world powers, Sky News claims. The broadcaster, citing anonymous defense sources, said that years of cost-cutting measures by successive governments have made the country's military a hollow force. The report, which came out recently, alleges that the unnamed American general had a frank conversation with Wallace and several other British officials last fall. The conclusion of the U.S. general regarding the U.K.'s fighting capabilities was unsettling for London. You haven't got a tire one, it's barely tire two. According to Sky News, the general classed the armed forces of the U.S., China, Russia, and France as Tier 1 powers, with Germany and Italy representing Tier 2 armies. Several unnamed British defense sources confirmed to the broadcaster that the nation's military is currently in a sorry state. One official was quoted as saying it's an entire service unable to protect the UK and our allies for a decade. The UK military would reportedly run out of ammunition in a few days if a conflict broke out. Moreover, the armed forces would likely be unable to defend the skies against the level of missile and drone strikes currently seen in Ukraine, the broadcaster claimed. The report said that 10 Downing Street has repeatedly cut the defense budget following the end of Cold War, leaving the British Army with hardware that is at least 30 years old and in dire need of replacement. London's active role in supplying Ukraine with weapons over the past 11 months has further diluted its own fighting capabilities, the news outlet said. Another major issue highlighted by anonymous defense sources is chronic staffing shortages. With only 76,000 personnel, the British Armed Forces are less than half the size they were in 1990, the Sky News claims. However, according to the government's plans, the military will shed 3,000 more troops down the road, while new weaponry is not expected to be procured for a few years, the report notes. Earlier, Conservative Defense Committee Chairman Tobias Elwood, according to Sky News, said people should be very concerned about the armed forces' current capabilities. Sky News said the senior Tory called on the government to reverse soothing cuts to the army because its equipment has become obsolete. Mr. Elwood said there had been huge investments into the Royal Navy and Royal Air Force in recent years, but added the army is in a dire state. He continued, "Our army is simply too small. We have cut down by 10,000 troops." France and Germany have announced plans to boost defense spending significantly. Prime Minister Sunak has yet to make any meaningful pledge to expand his defence coffers, instead pursuing a refresh of a review of defence policy that is due to be published on March 7th, ahead of a spring budget that will signal whether there is any new money for the military. The crisis in defence has been a generation in the making following repeated reductions in the size of the three armed services since the end of the Cold War by successive Conservative, Coalition and Labour governments to save money for peacetime priorities. In 2020, Boris Johnson, as Prime Minister of the UK, increased defence spending by £16 billion, the biggest uplift since the Cold War, but not enough to plug the gaps. Sunak has so far resisted calls to follow his predecessor, Liz Truss, to lift defence spending to 3% of GDP by 2030, up from just over 2% at present.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enemies engineered Iran's unrest meticulously, but failed due to wrong calculations. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of eulogists, and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Aliha. I've written down a poem by Sa'ib Tabrizi so that I can read it for you. He said, "Even if you tell me you shall not see me, I'll not despair like Moses did. When Allah turned to Prophet Moses and said, 'You shall not see me,' Prophet Moses let it go. But in this poem, he says, 'I will not despair.' Even if you tell me
You shall not see me. I'll not despair like Moses did. I know the sweet language of my love. Nice poem, but it's incorrect. He's implying that the Almighty God, God's divine being, is being coy when he says, you shall not see me. No, shall not see me means you shall not see me. God doesn't exaggerate when he says something. The poem is very beautiful, but the meaning is incorrect. So we have two things here. One is good poem and the other is good meaning, good content. You need to keep all of this in mind. Having said that, I believe we have been holding these kinds of meetings for 40 years now. And when I look at these now, compared to previous years, the work that is being done is much more advanced and better in terms of the types of elegies and poetry that is recited. There is no doubt about this.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
However, I'd like to draw your attention to some matters. While this is a form of hybrid art, what you are doing is a form of hybrid art, and art is beauty. We know this from our religious text. Our religious text, including the Quran, Nahjul Balagha, Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah, and many of our supplications. Regarding the Holy Quran, Imam Ali alayhi salam states, it has a wonderful appearance. Wonderful does not imply that it is just beautiful. It is stunningly beautiful. It has a wonderful appearance. That is how the Quran is. It is second to none in terms of its beauty and art. Almost all of the best Arabic poems, the sweetest and most beautiful and eloquent Arabic poems belong to the age of ignorance. Those poets were alive when the Quran was revealed. But none of them were able to find even a minute fault in the Quran or say that they could recite anything similar to it.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with the reporters.
The 53rd exhibition of Iran's nuclear industry achievements was inaugurated in Tehran on Thursday. The event showcases the latest nuclear products made in Iran. Attended by head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, the expo put on display different applications of the nuclear sector, from centrifuges to radiopharmaceuticals and particle accelerators.
Despite all external pressures, we have managed to advance our nuclear sector, and this expo shows a small part of it. Today, we have become self-sufficient in nuclear fuel, radio medicine, and many other fields such as heavy water.
In recent years, Iran has been trying to diversify the applications of its nuclear sector. Besides power generation, the country is now focusing on particle accelerators for food irradiation and radiotherapy.
Irradiation systems are being built in Iran on a national scale. This will allow the country to irradiate all its food and agricultural products. This way, we can reduce food waste, ensure food security for our people, and enhance our agricultural exports.
Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry in 2006, it has constantly been targeted by sanctions over what the West calls fears of a nuclear bomb, something which Tehran categorically rejects, saying its nuclear program is civilian and peaceful.
As you know, the West has long been leading a psychological campaign against Iran's nuclear activity, accusing Iran of pursuing non-peaceful purposes. So we held this exhibition for our people to see for themselves that our nuclear program is peaceful.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reinstatement of sanctions against Tehran in 2018, Iran took retaliatory steps by scaling back its commitments to the pact. The Vienna discussions between Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal, which aimed to revive the accord, have remained stalled since August last year. This, as Tehran says, it will come back to full compliance only if Washington removes all its sanctions.
By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions cannot disrupt its nuclear program. At the same time, the AEOI says it will continue to build up the country's nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Black Lives Matter. This is a popular slogan we often come across in the streets of the United States following the fatal shooting and beating to death of African Americans there. That began with the racially motivated killing of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, among others. Anger and shock once again prevail as American protesters march their cities to denounce police brutalities and demand justice for another victim, 29-year-old Tyre Nichols. The man was beaten to death by a group of officers in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, after he was stopped for a traffic violation in early January. Nichols was in confusion as to why he had been stopped, but before he could know, the cops started kicking, punching, and pepper spraying him while he was crying for help. Nichols was pronounced dead in a hospital 3 days later. Activists are still in disbelief on how the police could treat a member of the society like Nichols as an enemy in the battlefield.
Here I am now in 2023, and I'm looking at another video, this in color, where I'm seeing another black man being beat to death. Rodney didn't die. This is worse. It's beat to death with no mercy on no crime that they can even find that he had committed.
Here at Nichols' funeral, his family desperately called for an end to police brutality against the African-American community. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, who was also present at the funeral, slammed the killing and talked about an act that has a slim chance of getting passed in the Congress. Ironically, U.S. officials have turned up on such occasions in the past and made similar promises, but to no avail. Figures show that police brutality remained as rampant as it had been in the previous years. Law enforcement killed nearly 1,200 people, or about 100 people a month last year, making it the deadliest for police violence. Repeated shooting and lack of transparency have already terrorized America's black community. Many believe the reoccurrence of the brutal scene cannot be prevented by just suspending culprits. No African American will truly become safe from police brutality until its root causes are identified and dealt with.
The most prestigious cinematic event in Iran has kicked off once again, bringing together filmmakers, directors, and members of the cast and crew, as well as movie lovers and moviegoers in Tehran. The 41st edition of the Fajr Film Festival opened with the screening of the movie Maestro by Imad Hosseini, an adaptation of Alina by David Mamet. A clear sign that this year we should be expecting a very different film festival. First and foremost is the conspicuous presence of first-time directors.
24 movies will be competing in the main categories. These movies were picked out of 87 movies that were submitted to the Secretariat. All the 24 movies will be screened first in Tehran and in about a week in 30 provinces across the country. The screenings will continue until February 12th.
But that is not all. In the international section, nearly two dozen movies are also taking part. For many of them, this is a regional movie premiere, which is why, as always, the spotlight is on the festival and movies participating in it.
The first days of the festival can tell you a lot about what's going to happen, and by the looks of things, I'm personally expecting to watch some really great movies this year.
Movies will be competing for the top award or the Crystal Seymour in six different sections based on their stories. The Cinema of Salvation, Resistance, Muhammad Amin, and Eastern Vista being the most competitive sections, with all eyes watching to see which movies will take home the Crystal Seymour. For movie lovers and moviegoers, this is the time to be in Tehran. However, in less than a week, on February the 5th, movie theaters across the country will also be joining in. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The situation for refugees in and around the European Union is getting worse by the day. At a meeting of EU lawmakers in Brussels on Wednesday, it was announced tougher controls will be used on the border between EU member Bulgaria and non-member Turkey.
Like drones and radar and other means of surveillance. As we've done last year, for example, in the last years, for example, in Romania, we've done it in Spain and Greece and in Poland.
EU institutions and leaders are accused of breaking international law surrounding the protection of refugees.
What is the EU answer to these protection gaps? More walls, more drones, more returns, more funding to Libyan detention centres.
Campaigners say shunned refugees are fleeing countries destabilised by the West. At the same time, millions of Ukrainians are being welcomed here and given the same rights as EU citizens.
This is a clear, hypocritic, racist, organized policy that the EU practicing. And this is not a new thing. This is an historical discrimination that the EU stands for as an imperialist power in the world.
Legislators are calling on EU leaders to provide safe, legal routes for refugees.
We need to guarantee the right to asylum for those who need shelter so they are not shamefully piled up in refugee camps or illegally pushed back or drowned in the Mediterranean Sea.
The EU is currently developing a new asylum policy, but it's already shrouded in scepticism.
The Commission has to step up to break the cycle of mistrust existing between member states by enforcing also current rules.
Many EU nations are now struggling to accommodate the millions of Ukrainian refugees who have travelled here. Thousands more continue to arrive each day. Agencies across the EU that are already overwhelmed warn breaking point is being reached. They are demanding additional resources from governments. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
The 44th anniversary of the late Imam Khomeini's return to Iran from several years of exile, marking the beginning of 10 days of celebrations. In Iran, festivities have begun, with Iranians from all walks of life gathering in the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini to renew their pledge of allegiance to the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, while a special ceremony is also underway, demonstrating that the divide-and-rule policy of the enemies of the Islamic Revolution has failed.
I've come here to renew my pledge of allegiance with Imam Khomeini, who was an advocate of social justice and at the forefront of fighting oppressors worldwide.
Assyrians have been living in Iran for more than 3,000 years. This shows that no matter what our enemies do, we will remain united as a nation.
Over the past 44 years, we have managed to overcome many obstacles simply because we remain united, and it's important for our nation to remain that way.
A point that was also raised by the keynote speaker of the ceremony, Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf.
The Islamic Revolution is known worldwide with the name of Imam Khomeini, a great man known for fighting imperialism who always invited the nation to be united in the face of our enemies' plots and sets.